From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. The Ukrainian army is making verifiable progress in its counteroffensive in the south. That's according to independent analysts in the U.S. at the Institute for the Study of War. This counteroffensive focuses on the strategic southern city of Kherson. If they retake it and the surrounding towns, the conflict could turn. Kherson sits on the western banks of the Dnipro River. To talk about what's at stake here, we have Shashank Joshi on the line. He is defense editor at The Economist. Welcome.
Hello, good afternoon, Scott.
Shashank, why is Kherson so important?
Well, Kherson's important because it was the first major administrative center, the first major city to fall to the Russians back in the very beginning of their invasion, within a week of the invasion, in fact. It's also a very important industrial region. So if you look around Kherson province as a whole, this is an agricultural powerhouse, this region. It produces lots of the country's most important crops. And it's also geographically very significant. It's a kind of gateway to the western ports on the Black Sea that Russia does not control yet. For example, the port of Odessa being the most important of those. And it's in some ways the gateway in and out of Crimea, the Russian-occupied and Russian-annexed territory to the south. So all of those reasons are important. But I think the most important thing of all is that Ukraine has done very well to withstand the Russian advance. But it still is the case that Russia occupies around a fifth of the country. And Ukraine has to show at some stage that it is capable of taking back substantial amounts of territory. And Kherson is the first real test of that proposition.
And for Ukrainian military leaders, I gather this area and the city of Kherson is also symbolically important. 8 years to the day before this counteroffensive began, Russian forces, in the process of taking Crimea, killed more than 300 retreating Ukrainian soldiers. I mean, that's part of the recent memory here.
It is. I mean, it was called the Battle of Ilovaisk. It was a very important battle in 2014 between Ukraine and Russian-backed militia forces in Donbass, eastern Donbass province. And it was known as a massacre in Ukraine because when these forces tried to retreat from the city, they were killed, as you say, about 330 or more of them. So it is historically resonant, but that's to do with the date of the counteroffensive. That's not to do with the place. Kherson wasn't affected at all back in 2014. But of course, yes, as you say, the historical memory of that particular date, no doubt, will have been in the minds of the Ukrainian generals who planned the beginning of this offensive.
And as they try to retake Kherson, what is the strategy? We know Ukrainians have lesser firepower.
Well, I think the strategy is not a sort of D-Day type assault with huge mechanized forces flooding across the plains. The Ukrainians haven't got the manpower for that. They haven't got the equipment for that. What we're seeing is seems to be an attack by just a few brigades, pretty small formations. They're holding quite a lot back in reserve. They're committing some of their best artillery, some of their best armored vehicles, including French, German, American supplied guns, but they're not throwing all of their manpower at this. And I would say that the philosophy here is let's try and avoid storming the city if we can avoid it, because we know how destructive, how bloody urban warfare can be. And I would say the Ukrainian doctrine here seems to be advance a little bit, but advance in a way that you're penning the Russians in to a smaller space. Because don't forget, Kherson city is on the west bank of the Dnieper River. So you have quite a lot of Russian forces, perhaps 20,000 or so, all of them crammed into the space on the west bank of the river. Ukraine has destroyed most of the bridges, so they can't retreat very easily and they can't supply themselves very easily. So try and hem them in and then destroy them or force them to get away and move east rather than try and engage them in one big climactic battle.
So just thinking this through, if the Ukrainian troops indeed retake Kherson, what is the good case scenario for where this war goes from here from the Ukrainian perspective?
There's a lot more fighting to be done. If they retake Kherson, it would create a lot of problems for the Russians. They could lose a lot of troops. They would no longer be able to get to Odessa overland. It would be a psychological blow, and it would show the West that Ukraine can take back territory. So that would encourage more arms supplies from the Europeans, from the Americans and others. But at the end of the day, you would still have huge amounts of Russian forces on Ukrainian soil. You would still have Russians in the other parts of Kherson province, east of the Dnieper Dnieper River. You'd still have them in Zaporizhia province next door. You'd have them in Donbass, where, of course, they've been advancing, albeit extremely slowly, in the last few weeks. So an offensive in Kherson would be, a successful offensive would be a symbolically enormous significance, but it would nonetheless leave a huge amount of Ukraine still to be fought over, even after that point.
On the other hand, Shashank, if the Ukrainian troops don't succeed, they don't retake Kherson, what does that mean? Does it mean we have a continuation of this long and deadly slog of a war through the winter?
We're going to have a long and deadly slog through the winter, whether Ukraine wins this offensive or loses it or something in between. But if they fail, if they fizzle, and if they can't get closer to Kherson, or if they keep getting closer but they can't take the city even through the winter months, I think that's going to be a problem, because it's going to undercut Western support for Ukraine at a time when inflation is going up in the West, the cost of living is rising, energy prices are rising, and it may make it more difficult for Western governments to offer military and financial support to the Ukrainian government if there's a sense that this is futile, there's a sense that they can't take territory back. And I think it would also demoralize many Ukrainians, and it would be a setback for the Ukrainian armed forces. Now, I think people should not expect quick results. This is a war of attrition, and even when they're advancing to put themselves in a position to increase that attrition of the Russians, not necessarily to storm through the city in a matter of weeks or a month. So I think Ukraine has to manage expectations as to what it is actually going to be able to do on the ground, even through the autumn months.
They're also managing the news coverage of this. There is a blackout of sorts, or an attempted blackout. So we don't know a lot of the day-to-day specifics. Why is that? What would be the reason for holding back specifics to the news media?
Well, this is a long-standing feature of war. It's just we've become less used to it because of the nature of constant news and social media. But if you look at the Iraq war, if you look at reporters embedded with the U.S. Army, they weren't allowed to report the exact position of units or casualties taken or planes going out from a certain time. And this is a long-standing feature of any conflict. The Ukrainian army doesn't want the Russians to know precisely which roads they're moving down, which villages they're attacking, whether one unit is under strength and might be ripe to be counterattacked. These are very tactically significant details, and I can understand why the Ukrainians are withholding them. But nonetheless, this is war in the age of social media, and we are getting reports from, ironically, Russian sources, Russian military bloggers and military officials who are effectively giving away the location of where they are losing ground.
And briefly, if we can go 200 miles or so north and east of Kherson, that is where the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is, and we have heard a lot about that. There's fighting in and around this nuclear plant. Remind us what's at stake there.
Well, Zaporizhia is Europe's biggest nuclear power plant, and obviously everyone is worried about a nuclear accident of some kind, especially given that Ukraine has already had one in its history, the Chernobyl disaster of the 1980s. Mm-hmm. But I would emphasize that the biggest risk here is not something whacking into the main reactor of the plant. It's pretty well shielded and very well protected. The bigger concern, I think, is the electricity supply to the plant, because although it has diesel backup, there's only so long you can keep diesel generators running in a wartime situation. And of course, you have to keep not just the reactor running, but you have to keep the spent fuel, which is extremely hot. You have to keep that very cool, and you have to keep it stable, and you don't want that electricity supply to be disrupted. The fighting around the plant has intensified. The International Atomic Energy Agency, a UN agency, visited the plant last week to check on its condition. But I think there are real concerns, given that it's very near the front lines. And to a degree, it has become a political football, because the Russians have used it as a kind of shield for their military forces, knowing full well that Ukraine can't attack back without risking a disaster or risking a radiological accident on its own territory. So it's become a very, very sensitive site around which there's become a great deal of diplomatic and political as well as military confrontation.
Shashank, before we let you go, anything else you'd like to add?
I would just say that, you know, this is going to be a real test for lots of the things we haven't seen so far. Ukraine has done phenomenally well at defending for 6 months. It has defeated Russia around Kyiv. It has blocked their advance on Kharkiv, on Odessa. It has pushed away the Black Sea Fleet. It has killed tens of thousands of Russians. But for 8 years, Ukraine has been on the defensive. It just doesn't have that much experience of offensive activity. And I would say that we should not judge the Ukrainians just by their actions now. There are 10,000 Ukrainians being trained in the United Kingdom. Several thousand of them have already been trained. The EU is exploring its own training mission. I know that the US government is considering how it can expand training. The Ukrainians may only be in a really advanced position to conduct a proper offensive next year. And I think some people are anticipating that this could be over by Christmas, that this is, you know, approaching the end, this is exhaustion. And I would absolutely caution against that. Russia and Ukraine have fought each other for 8 years since 2014. And it would not surprise me if they're going to fight each other for many years hence. So this is not the end of the conflict. It's not even the beginning of the end. It's just a new phase.
Shashank Joshi is defense editor at The Economist. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks very much for having me.
We try to reduce your work, holiday or no. One of the biggest labor savers is a tool a lot of us take for granted, the index at the back of the book. It's been around forever. Well, actually, not so much. For centuries, there were no easy ways to find printed information. That's according to author Dennis Duncan. And he has published a book called, and pay attention here, it's called Index, comma, A History of the. Yeah, you get it. Duncan is a lecturer at University College London, and he joined us back in February to talk about the book. Why a history of the index, of all the things you could write about?
Well, that's a really good question. I think at the moment, we could, if you like, say that we're living in the age of search. But underpinning the search engine that we use dozens of times every day is this invention that came about at the start of the 13th century. It was invented by monks in Europe. It's an index. And Google will say this. Google says that their search engine operates according to two principles. One is crawling and the other is indexing. It goes away and it crawls the internet and it finds every single page. And then it puts it into an order so that you can find it. When you type something into Google, it doesn't go off and search the internet. It's already done that. It searches its index of the internet. So I think it's an interesting time now to think about the history of the index. How did we end up in the age of search? What is this thing that we do almost without thinking of it, this data structure that governs so much of the way that we use information digitally and with books?
Well, let's unroll a couple moments in this history that you write about. I understand one of the key moments was the arrival of alphabetical order.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so in order to have an index, you need two things. I mean, an index is really two columns. It's one that has a list of the things that you're looking for, and that has to be in alphabetical order, so you know how to navigate it. And the other is where to go, pointing, indicating where that can be found. So first of all, you need alphabetical order.
Then
you
need, finger, as it were. Right?
Then exactly, and then you need page numbers or something like that, locators. So alphabetical order, you think, okay, that's something that's been around forever. Really, it hasn't. And there's no particular reason that the letters of the alphabet are in the order that they are. The real reason that we have the letters of the alphabet in an order is because it makes it easier to learn them. If you're a school child going A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you sing the letters of the alphabet to the tune of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. That's why an order is really useful. But a big, incredible idea that happened at the Library of Alexandria round about just after the year 300 BC was, well, what if I take that thing that everybody knows, which is the order of the letters of the alphabet, and then I use that to point to something else? What if I have a table where the thing that you don't know where to find is mapped to the thing that you do know, which is the orders of the letters of the alphabet?
I understand one of the other big moments here in this timeline is preachers. At some point, preachers needed quick ways to find certain references in the Bible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we're talking about the start of the 13th century, the early 1200s here, and there are two big new things going on. One is the universities. The idea of the university has just arrived in the last few decades in Bologna and Paris and Oxford. And university teachers need to be able to use books in a faster way in order to write their lectures, in order to teach. And the other thing is the preaching orders. Instead of monks living in isolated communities who have literally all of their lives to read books, we have friars who live in the cities, who go out preaching sermons. Now, if you're going to write a sermon every week, you're going to need to use the Bible rather than just read the Bible. I'm going to do a sermon on, say, bread. Okay, well, the Lord's Prayer goes, give us this day our daily bread. And then I'm going to pivot from that to the manna. Then where else can I go for bread? So the index allows preachers and teachers, people who are writing sermons and people who are writing lectures, to use the Bible initially more efficiently.
I love your examples of index as weapon, right?
Yeah.
Page 114 in the book. 1965, we have two public intellectuals in the U.S., William F. Buckley and Norman Mailer. They spar. Mailer tells Buckley, you can't quote me in your book, right? Take it from there. What happens?
Well, Buckley does quote him. And then when the book comes out, Buckley sends Mailer a copy of the book. But before he puts it in the post, in the index at the back, page 336 or something, there's an entry for Mailer, Norman. And just against that entry, Buckley writes, hi. And what he knows is that when Mailer gets the book, the first thing he's going to do is turn to the back and see if he's in it. So it's a sort of, I see you. I see what you're doing. I see your narcissistic impulse to see if you're in the book. I've beaten you to it.
Yeah, for the egomaniac, I know where you're going to turn first. And I'm ahead of you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you're looking yourself up.
Yeah. What makes a good index, in your opinion? I imagine if you do it a certain way, it can be way too long.
Well, that's a really good question. Now, if you have a PDF or a Word document, you can hit Command and F or Control and F, and you can jump through that document looking for individual words. As long as you know the word you're looking for, every digital document, if it's a web page, comes kind of indexed in that way. And that's very useful for some things, but it doesn't work if you don't know the word you're looking for, if you're looking for a concept. So give you an example, going back to the Bible again. Imagine you had a PDF of the Bible, and you're thinking, what's that story? You know the story about forgiveness, the famous one about the son? The most famous story about forgiveness in the Bible, the prodigal son, doesn't include the word forgiveness. It doesn't include the word mercy. It doesn't include the word prodigal. So sometimes it's an idea that you're looking for rather than you don't know the exact word for it. So what makes a good index? I still think a human makes a good index. And what makes for a good index? One that intuits, how is this book going to be used? One that sort of second guesses what type of reader and what are the things that the reader is going to want to look up.
Well, perhaps this is, I've got your book in my hand here, and you have your book about index has two indexes. I guess I should ask you, is the plural indexes or indices?
I'm quite strict about this. I think the plural should be indexes. Now, if you speak to a mathematician or a statistician, they work with indices. But at the back of a book, you find indexes. This is because Shakespeare uses it. Shakespeare in Troilus and Cressida has a line about indexes. And you think, okay, well, if it's good enough for Shakespeare, who am I to stick to the Latin form?
The first index is a computer-generated index, and you just go through the A's here. And what's the point here? You have one that an editor, a human, makes after this, but what's the point here?
Well, the idea is there is currently software that you can buy and publishers sometimes use that will produce an index for you. And I wanted to show people that that's still not that good. The state of the art in artificial intelligence produced indexes isn't very good. So we get, I ran my book through an index generator, and it just crops phrases from the book. So I can't remember some of them they used, like all the words was a phrase they used. Alas, I've used 15 times or something like that. Nobody's going to want to look up alas or all the words or things like that. It's kind of surreal, actually, the things that get pulled out here. But it's also not very useful because you would have to spend so much time cutting it down. The second index in my book is a proper one, produced by a lady called Paula Clark Bain, who is a professional indexer, member of the Society of Indexers. And it's a masterpiece. If you have read my book and then you think, where's that bit about such and such, Paula's index will help you. She's incredibly done a great job of that, intuiting what are people going to want to look up here. But the other thing is, it's completely full of Paula's personality. This is why humans make good indexes or better indexes still, because it's so stamped with Paula's personality. She's training to be a crossword setter as well as an index, a cryptic crossword setter. So one of the things that you see in it is are these, you know, occasionally there's entries that are anagrams of other entries and stuff. It really has so much personality in, which is something that the software certainly can't do. Very, very proud of Paula's index.
Finally, Dennis Duncan, let me ask you about index cranks, I guess. I imagine over the years there have been people saying, well, listen, nobody's going to read anything anymore. If they're just going to Google something, if they're just going to go to the back of the book, nobody's going to read the actual book.
This is so true. But what I say in the book is that this has been around as far back as you want to go. This idea, nobody reads properly anymore. You can find in the early 1500s, you can find in the late 1400s, Erasmus, the great European intellectual of the first part of the 1500s, writes a book in the form of an index. And in the preface, he says, I had to do it this way because these days that's the only bit people read. So there's this kind of snark about if you give people a way of using books or only finding the part they need, then nobody will read properly anymore. And I suppose my argument is that's simply not true. We still read books and we use books and we read tweets and we read newspapers and we read advertisements. The idea nobody reads properly anymore is a complete misunderstanding of what the word read means. Read is an umbrella term for so many different modes, and indexes have been around for 800 years and they haven't killed off the book. So I think I have a slightly Pollyanna-ish approach to this, and I want to tell people it's all right. Use the index, use Google. Yeah, don't let the naysayers make you feel bad about the way that you read.
Dennis Duncan is the author of the new book, Index, A History of the, a bookish adventure from medieval manuscripts to the digital age. I guess read it from the front or the back, depending on how you want to go. Dennis Duncan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
In Chile, voters rejected what would have been one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. The proposal included new representation for indigenous groups and women, stronger environmental rules, and an expanded safety net. With us now from Santiago is John Bartlett. He is reporting the story for The Guardian. John, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So this would have replaced a constitution put in place by the military dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet in 1980. What were the big reforms proposed?
Yeah, it would have been a reasonably radical shift away from the 1980 constitution drafted under the dictatorship without any democratic input. And this one was, you know, the opposite of that. It was an incredibly democratic process. It was very transparent, perhaps too much so at times. And it would have enshrined broadly gender parity across government, you know, protection for the environment, recognition of Chile's indigenous peoples for the first time in the country's history, and then a huge list of social rights, which would have become law this morning had it have been approved.
Mm. Now, 2 years ago, Chilean voters decisively voted in favor of moving toward a new constitution. But now, as the details were spelled out, it went down decisively. Why did it go down?
Well, I think there are two different moments. The wave of the protests, which led to this constitutional process in the first place. At that point, there was a sort of an optimism around a new future. And ultimately, this time, it was a rejection of the proposal they put together rather than the process or the idea that people still want a new constitution. There was a lot of misinformation flying around. That was certainly a factor. There was a lot of rejection of the stipulations for indigenous people. Where that sentiment came from is something that we're going to need to analyze down the line as to why people didn't want indigenous people to have these kind of broad rights enshrined in a constitution. It's going to be very difficult to see what the way forward is now. I think power is very much now in the hands of those who have always had power in Chile. And so change or profound change, I think, is far less likely after last night than it was yesterday morning.
Mm. So what happens next? President Boric met this morning with party leaders and leaders in the Congress.
Yeah, it's a good question. What happens next was never clear. It was never really elucidated on by those who wanted to reject this proposal. They just wanted to reject it, and that was it. But we have three, I think, ways forward. One is to throw this draft to Congress and see what they can do with it. I think that's probably not going to happen. The most likely is a new constitutional process. What the base of that would be, we don't really know. And the other would be to reform the current 1980 constitution in Congress, which I think would be very unpopular, but is probably, you know, looks a lot more likely than it did very recently.
Does it seem to you that the social conditions are still in place to try this again? I mean, many of us remember 3 years ago, these massive protests brought about by increases in metro fares.
That wave has died down. That certainly isn't there anymore. You know, there's still lots of popular enthusiasm for a new constitution. But no, I think Chile's now changed. I mean, inflation is rampant here. The government is very unpopular. He's obviously, you know, swimming against the tide with the media here, which are largely controlled by the traditional sector of society, where a lot of the money is. So it's been very difficult for him. But he is quite unpopular. And I think that that movement is very much associated with him. And I think it's probably over now.
John Bartlett is reporting the story for The Guardian, and he joined us from Santiago, Chile. John, thanks so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Have you ever gone to a museum and wondered, how did that item get here? Who owns it? And who should? Well, several British museums are taking on those questions right now, and they have to do with items seized in the British Empire's colonial chapter. In 1897, they took more than 10,000 artifacts after a raid on Nigeria. Among them are key ancient artifacts known as Benin bronzes. And it looks like some are headed back to Nigeria. One person in the middle of this repatriation conversation is Neil Curtis. He is head of museums and special collections at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. Neil Curtis, welcome.
Hello.
Nice to have you. Your university last year returned a critical artifact that it bought at auction back in the 1950s. Can you describe this item and why it's so valuable?
Yes, we returned a late 18th century bronze casting depicting the head of an Oba, king of the Kingdom of Benin. And this was, as you mentioned, one of the ones that was looted in 1897, but the university bought it in 1957. But the more we've been thinking about it recently and the move towards repatriation across the world, we really felt that it was stolen property and should be returned. So we had a ceremony in Aberdeen where it was returned to representatives of Nigeria, of the court of the Oba and the National Museums in November, and it's now back in Benin City.
And recent weeks have brought more momentum on this front. About a month ago, Oxford and Cambridge pledged to return some 200 items total, and the Horniman Museum followed suit just a couple weeks ago, and that makes the first government-funded institution to hand treasures back. Are we onto something significant here?
Well, I think there's been a huge shift, but this has been something that's been happening for a while. You can go back to November 2019 when Jesus College in Cambridge University also committed to return, and then closer to you, the Rhode Island School of Design declared in November 2020 that they would return. But it took quite a long time to work out how to do it, who should be involved, who it should be returned to, what the process would be. So it really wasn't until October last year that we really had the first ones handed over to Nigeria. And I think we're seeing now that a lot of other people have been talking about it for a while. We've seen the Smithsonian, we saw Glasgow Museums also fairly recently spoke to Nigerian delegates who came to Glasgow, and they've returned as well. So there's really quite a shift.
And help us understand a little bit more why you think this is happening now. It seems on one hand, museums, cultural institutions have been kind of asking these broad questions. Seems like there's also been a lot of conversation or criticism on social media.
For many years, there have been demands that things be returned. The Oba of Benin was actually demanding return of things back in the 1930s, so it's not something that's new. However, I think museums in Europe and North America, their response has changed over the past few years. And I think initially it was a demand from Indigenous people in North America and Australia and New Zealand. More recently, we've been starting to think about places that were colonized by European powers, particularly in Africa just now. We're really focusing on that. And I think we really can't forget the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement really brought the how much African material was held in Western institutions, and really the feeling that this was something that was definitely wrong now.
I want to ask you about the British Museum, which in some of the materials I read appears to be maybe a little bit more resistant or slower to move. This year, the Grand Egyptian Museum is scheduled to open, and many have raised the Rosetta Stone, a central piece taken from Egypt. It is in the British Museum. Do you sense resistance? I mean, is there an argument, perhaps an argument we should know about, against returning items?
It sometimes tells you about what a museum is for. And I think traditionally we've often thought of museums as places which have treasures, and it's that possession that's really mattered. And over recent years, museums have started focusing more on how they work with people and those relationships, and so what things mean to people. Now, I think for national museums, like the British Museum, their identity is bound up with it being the treasures, the greatness, the history of the nation. So I think they have a harder job. I think they also, particularly in places like London and New York, where there are many international visitors, they also tend to think of themselves as showing things to the world. So they have a very different reality to those of a university museum or a civic museum. And certainly the British Museum, by dint of being the national museum of a colonial power, did acquire things from places around the world. So it has more of those items like the Rosetta Stone, like the Parthenon sculptures, like the Benin bronzes, than I think most other museums do. And it really has got into their being as a museum. If they lost those things, I think they'd feel lessened, which is not something that we felt for our mission as a museum.
So, I mean, you've described these various individual announcements by different institutions in the UK, in the United States, to return items to Nigeria and other African countries going back to colonial times. Should there be, or is there, a broader process to do this rather than kind of waiting for one institution at a time?
It comes down to the sort of laws of property ownership. That the University of Aberdeen was able to return the Benin bronze was because it had legal title to it. Therefore, it was able to make that decision. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to see a law that would affect the rights of ownership. We did see it with the return of items that had been looted or forcibly sold during the Nazi period in Germany and Western Europe, that there was law brought in that said, no, these things were illegitimately acquired and therefore they had to be returned. So I think there probably is a place for law. It's much easier within our jurisdiction. So I mentioned NAGPRA, that federally funded museums within the US are, you know, compelled to return things. But working internationally is much harder because you have all the different laws of the different countries and different types of museums. So it's going to be a really difficult process. And in many ways, I think what we've got to think of more are about ethics and trying to work out what is the right thing to do and encouraging all these museums to think in similar ethical ways. So with the Benin bronzes, I actually think it was a very, very simple decision. I mean, this was stolen property. All we were doing was returning it to its owner. I think there are other ones which are much harder where we don't have clear evidence of looting. And so that is very much a matter of ethical thinking about where is the right place for something to be.
And I understand University of Aberdeen, your university, still has many items, but perhaps the story behind those items, in some cases, is the story unclear?
The University of Aberdeen is, you know, it's an ancient institution founded 1495, and it's been acquiring things throughout its history. But the real burst of collecting, when the collection grew most, was in the 19th century with the growth of collecting sciences and with graduates going out and working in colonies around the world. So we look after material from all continents of the world, and they were given usually by graduates who didn't tell us a lot about how they acquired them. So we don't really know whether they acquired them as gifts or as purchases or whether there was trickery or coercion involved or, you know, outright force. So there are a few cases, and this is what we're starting to do, is to investigate the provenance where we can identify, like the Benin bronze, that it clearly was looted. So there was very little issue there. But for other ones, it's much harder. And indeed, sometimes I think it's better to think about the value of things to people today rather than sort of raking over and trying to prove exactly what happened 100 years ago.
That is, whatever the paper trail, let's talk about what the right thing to do is.
Yes.
Finally, is there any concern about returning artifacts? I mean, could they be abused, leveraged by autocratic governments to rewrite their history, anything like that?
I think the way in which objects are used and cared for is, you know, is very problematic, and you know, in all places. I mean, we've seen during the Second World War, museums in Britain were bombed and material destroyed. There's no real guaranteed safe place to look after anything. I think with some items like the Benin bronzes, you know, the point was that we didn't have a right to have it, so we're just returning to its owner. And in many ways, we don't have a right to then judge what the owner will do with their property. And I think we've got to think, you know, what is the benefit of returning things and not worry too much about what will happen. I think there's no guaranteed future for anything or any of us. And I think what's better is building these positive relationships today. And that might even include us, you know, lending or giving Scottish things for Nigeria so they can have that understanding of the rest of the world, not just having these international museums in Europe and North America.
Neil Curtis is head of museums and special collections at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. Neil, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
On this Labor Day, teachers and administrators at Seattle Public Schools are still negotiating a contract, which may end up delaying the first day of school, which is scheduled for Wednesday. Some members of the Seattle Education Association, the union, say they are voting to authorize a strike. Paraprofessional Cheryl Vaughn shared her story on social media.
I'm voting to strike because our special ed and our English language learners need more supports to make sure they're successful with their learning. I'm also voting to protect our personal leave. We can't be our best for students if we can't take time off when we need it.
Educators have until tomorrow morning to authorize a strike. Meanwhile, in Boston, down the street from our studios at WBUR, the Commonwealth Avenue Starbucks is entering day 50 of its strike, and employees are on the picket line this Labor Day. Barista Topaz Leo accuses Starbucks corporate of unfair labor practices.
They've been shutting down a lot of union stores and stores that have tried to unionize, and firing workers for trying to unionize, and taking away benefits from union stores, all of which is very illegal.
Leo says she hopes the company comes to the negotiating table soon. We reached out to Starbucks corporate for a comment. They're closed today. And we also contacted Seattle Public Schools and have not heard back. Now, aside from talking about the labor movement, today also marks the unofficial end of summer. And now is your chance to get that last dip in the pool before it closes for the season. Pools have been a refuge for many from record heat. But for author Alicia Abbott, her local pool near Boston was a refuge for other reasons. In this essay, she reflects on how this public space allowed her autistic son, Finn, to enjoy summer like everyone else.
When my son, Finn, wants to go to the pool, he points at a swimsuit. It doesn't have to be his. It could be mine or his sister's or even just a beach towel left by the door. Finn is 14, but doesn't speak with words. He is, however, fluent in sensations. He understands the feel of the water, the pleasure of kicking, of being splashed, of floating weightless and free. Swimming in cold water on a hot day is a delight, whether or not you have autism and mental delays like he does. This summer, my social media feed is again full of other people's vacation photos. Trips to Europe, weeks on Nantucket. My family goes to the Cape for a week every summer, but never with Finn. We haven't traveled together as a family in years. Even overnights are out of the question, at least since he moved into a residential home 5 years ago. And yet, I want Finn to enjoy the particular pleasures of summertime. And I want to enjoy at least some of these pleasures with him. The public pool makes that possible. We enter through the women's room gate. We walk to the back fence where we set up our bags, towels, and flip-flops.
So, Finn, let's put our towels down. Let's put them down right here. I know you're excited. Good job. You want to take your shoes off? Good job.
On the way, amidst the splashing and yells of Marco Polo, I hear bits of Portuguese, Korean, and Spanish. I see gender nonconforming couples and mixed-race families. There's a group of women in headscarves sitting in the shade. I used to feel anxious about being with Finn in public. His tendency to run away, to stim, or suddenly scream would always draw stares. But at the pool, everyone who sees us smiles. I feel more at ease with him here than almost anywhere else. At the pool, vignettes abound. A little girl in a pointed red swim cap holds her nose and takes a running leap into the water. Her brother soon follows. A tattooed and pierced couple embrace. They only have eyes for each other. It's hard not to love humanity on days like these.
Hi.
I help my 14-year-old boy learn to float.
Vinny, is it cold?
Woo! Chilly!
Nearby, a man teaches his small daughter how to swim. The difference in their size does not embarrass me, nor do Finn's little yips or the way he whips his head from side to side.
Oh, oh, that feels good, right?
Yeah, just kick.
Nice to meet you. So great. You're swimming.
The loud din of the pool drowns out his occasional outbursts. This is him. This is who he is. The richness of life on display at the pool makes space for all sorts of difference. There's nothing to hide here, nothing to stare at either. Finn's just a boy enjoying himself in the water like everyone else on a hot summer day.
Come on.
Have a nice night.
Thank you. Have a nice night.
Alicia Abbott is a local author in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her essay was produced by Cognoscenti, the ideas and opinions team at our home station, WBUR. We will link you to Abbott's essay at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C., wishing you a happy Labor Day. It's Here and Now.